I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospitals survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And we are joined this hour by Robert Wright. And Robert Wright, in 1994, took the nation in some ways by literary storm with his book, The Moral Animal, which became a great bestseller and a very important book for all of us to read and to wrestle with. He's written a number of books since then, like Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, and many other things. He's a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania and a Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. But we're going to talk about his latest book, The Evolution of God. And Robert Wright, welcome. Good to have you with us on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I really have enjoyed this book.
Oh, good.
It's provoking. You've done something here that, to at least in a, I think in a positive way, provoke believers, non-believers, theists, and atheists alike.
I hope so.
Let's talk about where you started with this book. In terms of the conception of why you decided to tackle this subject. I mean, because I like your kind of description of yourself as not really an atheist, not really a theist, for want of a better term, almost a mysterian in some ways, in all of this great mystery around us.
Yeah, I was brought up as a Southern Baptist, and so I have very kind of intense memories of my early encounters with religion. I was baptized when I was 8 or 9, I guess. But I have, I'm no longer a Christian, but I do remain very interested in God. And so the book is on the one hand told from, it's not from the standpoint of a believer. When I tell the story of the Abrahamic God, the God of Christians, Jews, and Muslims, I'm not assuming that any of the claims of special revelation in those faiths are true. On the other hand, I'm not really an atheist because I do think, and I argue in the book, that there is reason to think that there's some larger purpose unfolding through the workings of nature. And so I look at the story of religion in that light. But you're right, it's kind of hard to categorize me.
That's a good thing, I think, especially for this conversation and for this book. I mean, that... What's interesting is the way you look at God is like the God is undergoing a process that in some ways you see is very analogous to natural selection.
Yeah, I mean, the title, The Evolution of God, is not meant to refer to biological evolution,
right.
But it is meant to refer to this analogy that you mention. Anthropologists use the term cultural evolution to refer to the way ideas evolve over time, rituals evolve over time, music evolves, science evolves, all of, kind of the information that we humans share with each other evolves over time, and that includes our ideas about God. And so I, start the story really at the very beginning, back when all human societies were hunter-gatherer societies, back before recorded history, and try to piece together religion to the extent that we can from that age, and then move forward and focus mainly on the Abrahamic God. I cover the emergence of monotheism in ancient Israel, the emergence of Christianity, and the emergence of Islam. And yeah, there is evolution. I don't necessarily mean, some people when they hear evolution, they think of some kind of relentlessly progressive directional change. I do think in the long run that there has been kind of progress in the development of God and a direction in that development, but I don't mean at the same time that it's some kind of relentlessly linear progression. There's a lot of backsliding and a lot of kind of chaos in the middle of the story.
Well, a lot of chaos in the middle of the story, but let's start, if I might, just leap for a second beyond the pantheistic and the religions that took place in the shamanistic world, because I really find that when people wrestle with, as you have, and I remember interviewing Dr. Finkelstein, who you mentioned in your book a lot, wrestle with the reality of how God and the notion of God evolved to the Hebrews and who they really were.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of a very, I think, pivotal point to begin with, because I think the idea of the ancient Hebrews actually being polytheistic and moving to monotheism is something we don't wrestle with or think about very much at all.
Yeah, I think, you know, the standard story that is told about ancient Israel by both Christians and Jews is, I think, a little off. And that, and one of the things is what you refer to, that, you know, I think ancient Israel was polytheistic for a long time, you know, in contrast to the idea that once monotheism was revealed to Abraham and then to Moses, you know, Israelites were essentially monotheistic, except for the occasional straying, you know, to away from exclusive devotion to Yahweh, for which they were punished, and so on. I think the archaeological and really the biblical evidence, if you look at the text closely, is that until the Babylonian exile in the 6th century BCE, that really it was fundamentally a polytheistic culture.
But that flies in the face of a lot of faith that people have.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that by itself necessarily has to, but no, you're right. I mean, in general, you know, I am telling the story of God as being a concept that kind of is very responsive to facts on the ground, material facts about politics and economics. And in fact, when I explain the emergence of monotheism, it has a lot to do with the political context of Israel and the political aspirations of various kings. And you're certainly right that that whole level of storytelling is almost at odds with certainly conservative versions of the Abrahamic faith, because the idea with them is that why do you need to spend a lot of time explaining the evolution of monotheism? They would say monotheism happened because God came down and said, "I'm the only one,"
right?
You know, and that's the end of the story.
End of discussion.
Yeah.
No reason to write a book.
Right. Would have saved me a lot of time.
It would have.
I shouldn't have lost my faith.
I wouldn't have to read all these pages. But
right.
but let's just take, I think that before I go into El and Elohim, which I think is a good place to begin,
mm-hmm.
in some ways in talking about this and the roots of all this. And even when you get into the parts about Jesus and Muhammad later in the book,
mm-hmm.
that if you accept, if people argue and accept what we'll delineate in a while, that you lay out about these men and who they may have been as a historic reality and what they might have really said, it doesn't change the morality of what we wrestle with.
No.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, because in some ways what you're doing is really through the device of talking about the evolution of God and the Abrahamic religions, you're talking about the evolution of a moral and ethical point of view and way of life.
Yeah, I am focusing especially on the moral character of God, you might say, over the ages, because you know, in the scriptures of all three Abrahamic religions, in both the Quran and the Bible, sometimes God is acting in ways that today I think most of us would find reprehensible, really. I mean, in the Bible, there's in the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, there's a scene where God is telling the Israelites to annihilate nearby cities if they worship the wrong god, and expressly saying, you know, kill the women and children, you know, don't leave anything alive. And in the Quran, sometimes God says, kill the infidels. On the other hand, in both of these scriptures, the Bible and the Quran, sometimes God is counseling tolerance of people of other nations or of other religions. And so the question arose to me, why these mood fluctuations? Why is it that sometimes God seems like a nice guy, sometimes doesn't? Why does the moral character of God change over time? And so I addressed that question, and one thing I concluded is that, on balance, the moral character of God has gotten better over time. But you're right that those stakes remain. The moral stakes of the story remain in my telling, I think.
And I think that's at the heart of it. I mean, I think that well, before I jump into that, I'm going to go back to El and Elohim. I think that mm-hmm. when you describe how in the Canaanite text that people have unearthed, kind of opened the door to really wrestling with where the ideas and notions of the God of the Israelites came from.
Right.
And the battles they had between them. Talk a bit about that theory, which I think is kind of not even considered by most.
Yeah. Sometime in the 20th century, scholars who were conversant in the ancient dead language called Ugaritic, well, first of all, they became conversant in it, and then that enabled them to interpret various chunks of writing kind of around the northern part of what is now Israel and north of that. And you can loosely say that this is Canaanite culture. You know, Canaan referred to in the Bible as the land that the Israelites conquer. And one thing they discovered is that, okay, there was this pantheon of gods, and the head god was El or Ael, depending on how you want to pronounce it. It's spelled E-L. And one thing they discovered is that El, you know, in a lot of ways resembled the Israelite god, Yahweh. And that's interesting in its own right, but even more interesting is that in the Hebrew version of the Bible itself, God isn't always called God, Yahweh. Sometimes God is called El, you know, same word. Now,
right.
That by itself doesn't tell you for sure that actually Yahweh and this Canaanite god El are the same or have a common heritage or anything, because the word El also was just a generic noun for God, like it meant like deity. You could apply it to any deity. So, and you can't tell kind of when they meant to capitalize the noun and make it a proper noun, a real name for the Canaanite god El, because they didn't use capital letters in the Hebrew Bible. So it's not really clear-cut, but certainly I would say most biblical scholars now believe that there is some kind of connection, historical connection, between the Canaanite god El and the god that Israelites call Yahweh. There's a lot of little interesting pieces of evidence. I mean, one of the most interesting is when in Exodus, when God is quoted as saying, you know, when I revealed myself to Abraham, I didn't call myself Yahweh. I called myself El Shaddai, which is like two words, like El, the God El, and then Shaddai is a modifier. But I want you to know that I am actually Yahweh, okay? So it's as if maybe there were two separate traditions about what God was called. And at this point in the Bible, with this verse in Exodus, which we think was written probably after the emergence of monotheism happened, it's as if they said, you know, they were taking two gods and convincing people that they were actually one, and previously people had not thought of them that way. So there's all these interesting clues that the story of God is much more complicated and interesting than the standard story that, okay, you had this one God, Yahweh, always the same God, no intermingling with these evil Canaanite gods. You know, there's clearly a lot more that was going on, even though we can't piece all of it together yet.
So if you look at just that one part of the story that you're telling, that there's a lot of, and part of the story is that perhaps Moses never existed.
Possibly,
never existed. That the Israelites actually lived and were probably Canaanites.
Well, what I would say about that is the idea, what's been debunked pretty thoroughly by archaeologists, and I'm sure that Mr. Finkelstein said the same thing when he was on your show, because he has done a lot of this
Yes.
archaeological work.
Right.
What has been I think, fairly thoroughly debunked is the idea that it's told in the Bible, that there were these Canaanites, and the Israelites were a people that came from wholly outside of Israel, and they conquered the Canaanites and displaced them. It looks more and more like Israelite culture emerged from within Canaan. At least it may be that they later, that the Israelites, that one group of Israelites later merged with outsiders to form Israelites proper or something, but it's clear that Israelite culture, to a large extent, actually emerged from Canaan. These were not fundamentally outsiders. It was a native culture.
One of the ideas, though, I think that is important here, again, in a larger context that you write about, is the importance of the evolutionary theory of God for you, that we have created this sense and battle over the sense of God, and it's almost like a dialectic interaction that's taken place over thousands of years about what we believe and what we should believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that makes kind of the kind of wrestling with the notion of God, as many Jews say, just wrestling with God, the idea of wrestling with that idea, becomes a more profound notion rather than just accepting things on a page.
Yeah, I mean, I do like to think that my book would be an intellectual challenge for believers in a way that it wouldn't be for non-believers. I think it's of interest to non-believers and maybe easier to accept. Maybe we'll go down more smoothly. But I think, you know, a lot of believers are interested in constantly trying to reconcile their religious beliefs with what is known about the world. I mean, religion has clearly evolved in response to science, for example. You know, the conceptions of God have changed. A lot of people, you know, I think back in ancient Israel, he was literally thought of as a guy in a throne with a beard. And by the way, that's actually the way El was depicted, this Canaanite god. And I think people in a scientific age think, you know, okay, not literally maybe sitting up there in a particular throne, you know, we're amending our ideas of God. So I think our ideas of God have been evolving all along to accommodate new findings. And I do think that I've tried to in this book, put together a lot of things that believers will find challenging.
Now, but one of the things you say that's a thread that might run through all the Abrahamic faiths, that fits the modern world and might have made them all survive to this point, is the notion of salvation.
Yeah, they all they have different kinds of notions of salvation. Of course, the Christians, salvation normally refers to a kind of an individual affair, a personal affair. An individual is saved, as you know, like when I went to the front of the church in response to the altar call when I was 8 or 9 and then was later baptized, that was individual salvation, and the idea was that now I could be assured that my soul would live, you know, forever in heaven. And that's individual salvation, and Muslims have something very comparable. In the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, the term salvation is usually used in a different way to refer to the salvation of the nation or sometimes the world, but it's more about like saving the social system from chaos. There are only fleeting references in the Hebrew Bible to kind of the afterlife, the individual afterlife, and that's not what salvation is fundamentally about. And I think that's to some extent still true of Judaism, that there's not nearly as much interest emphasis on individual salvation or the afterlife as there is in Christianity and Islam. But the word plays a prominent role in different ways in all three scriptures.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking with Robert Wright. His latest book is Evolution of God, something to provoke us and make us think about where our notions of God come from, what they might mean to us now in this modern world, which we're going to walk ourselves towards in the course of this hour. Lines open at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to the Facebook and let's see what you have to say there and see what comments you have there, and we'll read those on the air as well. 410-319-8888. So I want to kind of get a very kind of I don't want to do cliff notes, but the
I can do cliff notes
because we could spend hours on just kind of parsing out pieces of your book. But if you take us for a moment in your book from the point where you say that Judaism became a monotheistic religion, and then before we get to Muhammad, I want to walk us into the Christian era when you search for the historic Jesus, and when you talk about how the Gospels were written and how this kind of changed and moved, in some ways, you might even argue, advanced the notion of God.
Mm-hmm.
Just give us 5 minutes to kind of take us to that.
Christianity, okay, I would say, I mean, first of all, quickly, I would say I actually think God makes a great leap forward in moral terms before Christianity, but after the exile. The exile, again, is when the Israelites had been conquered by the Babylonians and humiliated by them, and some of them had been sent to Babylon, and Israel was in a bad way. That's when I argue monotheism emerged. And at that point, God, I've got to say, exhibits some pretty nasty characteristics, is very much about retribution, punishing Israel's past enemies, and so on. But I do argue that right after the exile, when what happens is Cyrus the Great of Persia conquers the Babylonians, and now he's in charge of the Israelites. He sends the exiles back to Israel, gives them freedom of religion. They are now a secure part of the empire. And I argue that at that point, God becomes a much nicer God, more broadly compassionate. And the reason I'm saying is because at that point, the Israelites finally felt secure, and they were not surrounded by enemies. And I think that's the key to religious tolerance is... and in fact, I've made comparisons between the Israelites during the exile, when they felt dispossessed and threatened, and the Palestinians now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that that kind of situation brings out the belligerence in a religion. And if you want to bring out the tolerance and moderation in religion, you have to make people feel secure and respected. So that's a primary moral of the story of the book, is how you bring out the best in a religion. And I don't think it makes sense to say, well, is such and such a religion of peace? Is Islam a religion of peace? I think any religion can be a religion of peace or of war. It depends on the circumstances you put the people in. But anyway, as for your question, okay, so then Christianity, then Jesus comes along. You know, it's hard to piece together the historical Jesus, the real Jesus, with confidence, but my view is that he was much more of an apocalyptic, a Jewish apocalyptic preacher than you might think to read the Gospels. I mean, I think there are glimmers in the Gospels of his being really fundamentally focused on Israel.
Mm-hmm.
There are glimmers of that. But I think they're kind of covered up by parts of the Gospels that accumulated later, after Christianity had become an international religion. I think that happened basically after the crucifixion, especially under the influence of the Apostle Paul, who built this international church in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was a multinational empire, and he established churches in these various nations, and naturally enough, he encouraged brotherly love among these people of different nations. It helped hold the church together, for one thing. But I think this was a real shift from the emphasis of Jesus himself, and I think you find bits of that in the Gospels, of what I think is a truer picture of Jesus as being a kind of a traditional Jewish apocalyptic preacher.
And well, we're going to take a short break and pick up on that point and talk about Philo and the notion of logos and where this takes us in the global economy of ideas today in this world. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Robert Wright, whose latest book is The Evolution of God. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Robert Wright, whose latest work is The Evolution of God. The number is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. The lines of phones, calls coming in. We'll come to your calls in just a moment. Let me just lay a few more things out here, then we're going to open the phones to you all to join in on this conversation with me and with Robert Wright. I want to talk about a man who I, in some ways, for me, feels like a moral centerpiece for your book, a centerpiece that kind of leads us into the future in terms of the way you seem to have fallen in some ways under his spell, and that's Philo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Philo of Alexandria was a Jew living in Egypt at the time that Jesus lived. He was a philosopher and a theologian, and he was trying to reconcile his Judaism with Greek philosophy. So he was an interesting intellectual figure, and I think he's a very very laudable guy and had a very forward-looking theology and really a very almost, you know, prophetic, prescient theology that anticipated much of what has happened in the world. And in the book, I say that, you know, his theology is in some ways a good candidate for a theology that would be viable even in a modern scientific age. You could, you know, it's not really discredited by modern science, and in some ways is vindicated by the direction the world has gone in. And his theology centers around this word logos. Now, logos, Christians don't realize it, but logos figures centrally into some of the most famous passages in the New Testament. In particular, the part of John early on that says, "In the beginning was the Word," and then it equates the Word with God and with Jesus. And the Greek word that was translated as Word is the word logos, and it didn't really mean word in Greek. I mean, it was a philosophical term that referred to a kind of a logic that was running through history and animating history, and it meant a lot of different things, and different philosophers had different versions of it, but that's the word that is translated as word in that phrase, "In the beginning was the Word." And Philo, at that very time, you know, even before the Gospel of John was written, probably decades before, Philo was doing his own writing about the Logos, and he depicted it as this force that was... it was a divine force. It was kind of a representative of God. It was doing God's work in the material world, and it was kind of an algorithm or a force or a logic that drove history forward, and he thought it drove history to a better place. And it made on balance that humanity would get better and more humane, and there would be more love among humans. And he, in particular, emphasizes something that's interesting right now, which was interdependence. Okay, the idea that what would draw people together was kind of mutual needs, you know, like if neighbors, you know, say neighbors have, one of them has butter but is out of milk, and the other one has milk but is out of butter, and they trade and they're both better off, you know, that's what game theorists call a non-zero-sum game, and that's the basis of interdependence, when people can meet each other's needs, and globalization is full of that, right?
Yes.
You know, our cars are built by people in who knows how many different countries that we're dependent on, and then we make things and send them around and so on. And Philo, this was central to his vision of the future of the world, which he said was a divinely driven future where the peoples of the world would come to need one another more and more, and by meeting each other's needs would be drawn into a giant global community, a global democracy, he said, and that was part of God's plan. And I actually think that there has been enough of that kind of direction in history to really raise the question of whether, you know, that maybe that is the purpose of it all. Maybe there is a divine purpose. I mean, leave aside the fact that Philo said it, I would say just observing the direction of human history, the trajectory toward globalization. I mean, not that there hasn't been a lot of bad, and not that globalization itself doesn't bring a lot of bad, but the way the world's peoples have been woven together in this almost inexorable way, I think is an interesting enough pattern to raise the question of whether this isn't part of a divine plan.
And I want to read a closing paragraph to your chapter on Logos, because I think it will give our listeners a real sense of how you move this book along and the questions you want us to wrestle with. You mind?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Your closing paragraph was, but what if what the Bible says about Jesus isn't true? What if Jesus didn't really say all the compassionate things attributed to him? What if it turns out that one of the few things we can say about Jesus with much confidence is that he was quite different from the Jesus depicted in the Bible? Does that make him less an incarnation of the Logos? And should it sap our faith in the Logos? Now, I think that's important because one of the things that I think in some ways your book argues that is that whether or not all the things are factually true that we read in these great works of the Abrahamic faiths, that it is what they have us wrestle with is what's important to change the way we act and live and to change the world.
Well, yeah, and they also, first of all, I think there has been moral progress in human history. You know, we take for granted that all of us probably, I hope all your listeners, you and I would say that people everywhere, regardless of race, creed, or color, are people and deserve to be treated with respect and so on. We take that belief for granted in the modern world, even though not everybody holds it. Still, it's widely enough held that we take it for granted. Well, you know, 2,500 years ago, this was not a common view. You know, there has been moral progress. And I think you see in all of these scriptures steps in that progress, okay? So you see, especially in some of the writings of Paul, for example, in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians, all those in the 13th chapter, the testaments to the beauty of love and so on. You see, and in the Quran and in the Hebrew Bible, you see steps in this progress. And so I think even if it turns out that this stuff is not literally true, and my assumption is certainly that it's not literally true, it could be the case that you are seeing in these glimmers of moral progress, you know, kind of manifestations of the divine. Mm-hmm. And you're right that, yes, we are witnessing humanity's struggle with these great moral questions, and our own struggle with them can be illuminated by seeing how our ancestors struggled with them, as is reflected in these texts.
Let me open the phones here and let people question what you've been talking about, and we're going to then move into some other aspects. I think that your chapters on Muhammad and the jihad are something I really want to try to get to as well. 410-319-8888. Robert Wright is our guest. His latest work that we're talking and wrestling with today is called The Evolution of God. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com or just log on to the Facebook page and we'll get you on that way. And Joe in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello. Great.
Hi, Joe.
Great. How you doing? Great discussion. You always have one, Mark.
Thank you.
I had a question that has, you talked about the evolution of God, and I think it's clear that it's an evolution of our thinking, but it's also, as the world gets smaller, as people get to closer to each other and get to see each other, we have to start thinking about God differently because, you know, to make sense of the world, you know, you just mentioned that seeing people as people wasn't a universal thought years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think as the world is shrunken, you know, that we can get to see people, we see that people are people. I had a question about also the evolution of, in history, things always change. And my question was, you mentioned Jesus as Jewish, but that's, I think that's a different interpretation. I mean, what a Jew was in Jesus' time is different from what most of us think of a Jew is now. And I think that I'm right about that. And I want, if you could expound on that, because I think, because of history and, you know, with pictures and so forth, we see a picture of Jesus that was a European version. I don't want to think about black or white, but I want to get a sense of you would naturally assume that if he was Jewish, he was a person who lived in that land and looked like the people who lived in that land. And I think it would be good for us to look at that, you know, as a world, because I think that would help us see, you know, help us get a sense of evaluating people for who they are.
Yeah, on your first point, the idea that as the world gets smaller, it forces us to reckon with one another. That's really a fundamental part of my book in terms of arguing that in a way the world is set up to confront us with the challenge of progressing morally. The world has kept getting smaller and smaller thanks to technology for millennia, for a long time. And repeatedly what it does is it says, look, either you learn to get along with these people who used to seem so far away and are closer now, or you pay the price of social chaos. So even in the time of early Christianity in the Roman Empire, you had these nations that had been newly put in a single empire. And the challenge was, you know, either you learn to get along or bad things are going to happen. And the evolution of Christian doctrine was an important part of helping them get along, the idea of a love that crosses national bounds, as Paul taught. So, and now we face a bigger challenge, which is like the whole globe, either we all learn to get along or the whole thing might fall apart. So I'm very much in tune with that part of what you said. As for Jesus, yeah, he was a Jew. It's very clear, and he was schooled in the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians call the Old Testament. The term did have somewhat different meaning. I mean, for one thing, it was more of a national allegiance because the nation of Israel still existed, even though it was under Roman domination. It was much more of a nationality than Judaism might be thought of today by Jews outside of Israel. As for what he looked like, I would assume that he looked very Middle Eastern, you know, he was in Palestine, and I don't know that I could draw a sketch. But I certainly think it's true that Western European artists have depicted him as looking more like them than he probably did.
Right.
I suspect that the kind of classic rendering of him that I remember from Sunday school looks a little more like me than what's the case, you know, except for the hair and the beard.
Thank you so much for that call. Joe, 410-319-8888. Stan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. The issue that I have deals with the general conclusion that you have reached in the book and that you repeated on the air, that the moral character of God has gotten better. And I struggle with the logic of that conclusion. You go back and you talk about the time when the Jews were sent into exile in Babylonia about 600 years before Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you spoke of God as being sort of a vengeful God, being a bad guy, as you just said on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some 2,500 years later, in the 20th century, the Jews are not sent into exile. The Jews are slaughtered in the millions. And the Jews are not only slaughtered in the millions in the 20th century, but the Cambodians are slaughtered in the millions. Stalin slaughtering his own people in the millions.
Mm-hmm.
Mao slaughtering people in the millions. And today, in Africa and elsewhere in the world, people are being slaughtered in the millions. I really struggle with your argument, or your conclusion to your argument, that somehow the morality of God has mm-hmm. gotten better. How do you support that argument?
Well, first of all the people you mentioned as doing the slaughtering there, who Pol Pot, Stalin, Hitler, who else? None of them believed in God. They were all atheists. These are not people who said, well, the Christian God or the Jewish God or the Islamic God tells me that it's right to do the slaughtering. In fact, almost all of the great atrocities of the 20th century were committed by atheists. So I don't see how that is inconsistent with what I'm arguing.
Well, but from what Stan was saying, let me just jump in to kind of if part of what you're arguing is that God is, whether God is real or not real.
Right, that is in a way the question. I mean, if Stanley's assuming that I'm saying, look, God is in charge of this planet, and when bad things happen, it means that God is bad, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying our conception of God has, on balance, and even here, there are exceptions and there are asterisks, and I would carefully qualify it. But what I'm talking about is our conception of God's moral fiber, which is really a reflection of our own moral caliber, okay? So, let's take an example just within the framework of Christianity in a very short time frame. There's a story in an early gospel of Jesus doing something that sounds kind of strange, which is he refers to a woman as a dog, apparently because she is not Jewish. Now, by the time of Paul, some decades later, there's an explicit doctrine of Christian love that crosses national bounds. I think there's been progress in that period. Now, in the conception of God, and therefore, to some extent, in the moral character of the people who are doing the conceiving of God. So, yeah, I'm not arguing that. That a God who runs the world is doing a better and better and more humane job of it. I am arguing that our conception of God has, on balance, with a lot of backsliding, gotten more morally rich. But more than that, I'm arguing something about the specific circumstances that bring out the best in God, and that is that when a group of people looks at another group and says, okay, they're not a threat, we can do business with them, we can benefit through peaceful coexistence, then those people tend to find a basis for tolerance in their scripture. That's the key thing. I show in the book that all three Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have shown that capacity to adapt to a situation of interdependence in a constructive way. And I think that's the basis for hope in the modern world, is the fact that these religions are flexible in that way, that when the logic of interdependence encourages strongly enough tolerance, then there's a good chance you'll see it. Because in the world today, more and more, I think the logic behind tolerance is there.
We're talking with Robert Wright, who wrote the book, The Evolution of God. And before we go back to the phones at 410-319-8888, Stephen in Cockeysville, you're the next caller up. I want you to follow up what you were just talking with Stan about, in that if part of your thesis in this book, at least the way I understood it, is that you're really tracing an evolution of God that is in some ways an evolution of our moral and ethical growth, mm-hmm. and the battles around it. And every time you look at a specific historical event in one of the Abrahamic religions, you always kind of give it an almost in some levels an economic determinist reason for fueling that change. And a lot of what your descriptions of why ancient Israel became more tolerant at different times.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that, if looking at it that way, I mean, all the things that Stan just outlined in terms of our kind of failures morally and ethically as human beings and as human culture, how does that fit into the thesis of this notion of our changing ideas about God growing and creating a stronger moral and ethical world?
You're right that I do trace kind of the moral fiber of a people at a given time, the moral perspective of people at a given time, to facts on the ground. In fact, an important moral for the modern world is I think that the so-called religious conflicts in the world are usually not about religion. Yes, religious people claim they're killing in the name of their God. They always do if they're religious, and then if they're not religious, they'll just claim they're killing in the name of something else.
Mm-hmm.
But what is driving the violence and intolerance, I argue, is facts on the ground, like especially zero-sum conflicts where one side has to win, one side has to lose. I think ultimately the conflict in the Middle East was not about religion. It was about land. And that's a zero-sum contest, and then it became more and more religious over time. So you're right. I trace the difference, whether people are belligerent or tolerant at any point in time, I trace the facts on the ground. Now, as for how that could explain moral progress, I think the facts on the ground over the long run, over the millennia, have drawn all of us more and more into this web of interdependence that we referred to earlier, and that in the long run, religions tend to adapt to that by growing in their tolerance. When people really accurately perceive that they're in the same boat with another group of people, and increasingly we are in the same boat with everybody in the world, then they tend to be forced, partly out of self-interest, to acknowledge the humanity of these other people and say, okay, we can work with them, we can do business. I think that material fact about technological evolution largely has driven this moral progress I'm talking about. So that's how I'd reconcile these two things.
Robert Wright, who's written the book Evolution of God, is with us today. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Stephen in Cockeysville, you're on the air.
Thank you. My question, Mr. Wright, is you said that you're inclined to believe that the real Jesus was more apocalyptic than what we might understand from the New Testament. My question is, what leads you to think so, and what other resources are available that are a better witness to the person of Jesus than the New Testament?
Well, first I'd say I think the Jesus of the Bible is quite apocalyptic. I think the historical Jesus was apocalyptic in a more kind of, you might say, Jewish way. In other words, he was more concerned. The apocalypse, for the average Jewish apocalyptic preacher, would have been a time they were envisioning when Israel would have been restored to greatness. So it wouldn't have been so much about the salvation of Christian souls all over the planet as about the restoration of Israel to greatness. And that's what I'm suggesting is the case. Now, as for the basis of that belief, I would say a certain amount of it is in the Gospels in light of what scholars have taught us about when the different Gospels were written. So, for example, Mark, although it's not the first Gospel in the Bible, seems to be the oldest. John is the latest, the most recently written. It was written decades after Mark, apparently. And all of these were written after Paul's letters. So things like that allow us to kind of get a sense for how the story was developing. I mean, it's common to say there are contradictions among the Gospels, and that's true. But once you know the order in which the Gospels were written, that allows you to say a little more than that there are contradictions. It allows you to get a sense for how the story about Jesus was changing over time in the decades after the crucifixion. And I would say, and certainly some scholars agree with me, that you see Jesus moving toward the kind of figure that's more familiar to modern Christians, one who's concerned with kind of love that crosses, love of a universal global sort, the saving of souls of people in all nations, that seems to be something that's not clearly part of the original post-crucifixion story about Jesus. But the short answer is a lot of it, the basis, you know, and I get into this in the book at great length. I spend a chapter looking at this question of when the different Gospels were written and what things you see in different Gospels. So no point in my trying to kind of make the case here, but I do pay a lot of attention to the need to present the evidence in the book.
No, I would think, one thing I suggest is a lot of people who have study groups this in their own homes or book reading clubs or in your churches or synagogues or mosques have these reading clubs. I think it would be, I'd recommend everybody kind of who is on those groups to kind of take this book and wrestle with it. And I think that, I think it's to me, that's the importance of this book. It's something to kind of wrestle with and argue about and discuss. But you towards the end of your book, you have this great two quotes back to back here, where you write, according to the book of Genesis, God created man in his own image. According to Aristotle, men create the gods after their own image.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, you see this is a history in some sense of history and evolution. Of an illusion, let me be clear. So,
I do think people originally conceived of gods kind of in their own image, right? I start the story well before the Abrahamic God, back in kind of hunter-gatherer days. It does seem like at that point they're kind of making up these stories about gods to explain why good things happen and bad things happen, which they desperately want to know. And then these ideas of gods evolve over time into the more familiar God. But the fact that God started out in that sense as an illusion and evolved does not mean that there's no such thing as the divine, and it does not mean that this evolution of our conception of God is not leading us to a truer conception of that divine. That's the thing I try to emphasize, and that's what has gotten me into the into trouble with atheists.
so talk about what it means to you, and you use this word in the book, and you've used it several times in this conversation we've had over the last hour. Your notion, what you have come to about this idea of the divine, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's a pretty fuzzy notion, and I guess one point I try to make in the book is, if there is a God, if there is something you can call the divine, it's very unlikely that human beings can clearly conceive of it. The human mind was designed by evolution to do just mundane things, get food, you know, find mates. Science itself is telling us, physics is telling us, the human mind cannot grasp reality at the fundamental levels of physics. We can do the math, but we can't conceive of what it's really like. So it's very unlikely that we're capable of conceiving of ultimate things like God or the divine. So I don't have a clear answer to that. I do think that, you know, there is evidence for something that you could call the divine, at least if the divine has to do with a moral order in the universe. I do think there's evidence of a moral order in the universe, and I lay that out in the book. And a moral order that's evident in human history, and that human history has brought us closer to appreciating and realizing. And I guess I would say, to me, the divine would be the source of that moral order. It would be the thing that kind of built the moral axis of the universe. But I'm not a theologian. I do not have clear religious beliefs. And so people should not turn to me for guidance as far as what God asked.
I wasn't trying to push in that position, but but what you do believe in the power of what you call in your other books as well, the non-zero-sum game or solution.
Yeah, and I mean, that is to say, a situation where there can be a win-win outcome or a lose-lose outcome. It can go badly or well, and both people can win or both can lose, as opposed to a zero-sum encounter, like, you know, in a tennis match where every point is good for the person on one side of the net and bad for the other. The non-zero-sum is more like doubles, when the person on your team, right, they're in the same boat as you, so every point is either good for both of you or bad for both of you. I do think history has moved us toward more and more non-zero-sum situations, and that has moved us toward appreciating the humanity of other people, if, again, only out of self-interest. And, yeah, I believe in the power of the non-zero-sum situation, and I believe the fact that technological evolution has driven us toward these situations that are morally illuminating is one thing that is suggestive that maybe there is some larger purpose unfolding on the planet.
And one final thing. We only have a few minutes to the end of the hour here, and I think that You talk, especially towards the end of the book, about the world we're in now. And you kind of lead us into that in many ways by talking about the wrestling, as the West does, with the Muslim faith, and the Muslim faith wrestling with itself.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about the danger we have of looking at it at the Muslim world, which you talk about Muhammad as being a very modern thinker,
mm-hmm,
in your book. But we see it as jihad in many ways because we don't really get the complexities of that as we might get the complexities of the other two Abrahamic religions.
Yeah, I mean, I think Muhammad was a pretty modern thinker, both as a kind of a theologian, which I talk about in the book, but also as a, you know, he was a prophet, he was a politician, and he was a warrior. And I see him as, in those regards, being very pragmatic. I mean, the stereotype of Muslims in the West among some people is kind of totally caught up in religious fervor. Muhammad was almost the opposite. He was a very cool pragmatist in my reading, and I think that helps make sense of some of the so-called jihad verses in the Quran. They are quoted out of context, and look, they definitely were enlisted in war. He was at times at war, and when it says go kill these guys, it meant go kill these guys. But if you look at, you know, sometimes the verses are yanked out of context, so it says things like kill the infidels wherever you find them. You know, you see this on right-wing websites as evidence that the Quran is all about indiscriminate killing. Well, first of all, it's not kill the infidels. The proper translation is kill the polytheists. But more than that, if you look at the verses right around that verse, it says, you know, basically it says, except for the polytheists who are on our side in this war.
Right.
And time and again you see that Muhammad is pragmatic in that way. He is willing to form alliances with people regardless of their religion, And these the so-called jihad verses basically just mean, let's go kill the enemy in this particular war. And that's what warriors have always said, Christian warriors, Jewish warriors, Islamic warriors.
Robert Wright, I wish we had more time because I just there's so many more things I would ask you, but maybe another day. And I do thank you for joining us this hour. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, I really appreciate what a close reading you've given the book, Mark.
Well, thank you so much. Robert Wright has been our guest. His book, Evolution of God, well worth the wrestling and the read. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. August is Urbanite's annual stories issue featuring fiction, poetry, memoir, and plays from the region's emerging writers. Plus a sneak preview of the upcoming art season, look at Changels and Troubles, Sandtown. Urbanite is available at over 700 locations. Find out where at www.urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. Jamara Jones engineered us tonight. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Devin Finley, and Brad Kolodner, and Brian Boone, who worked the boards and helped us get the show through tonight. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our other shows, hear new interviews, visit us at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.